Chapter 9. Teddy. Papa did not want me to travel on my own back to Boston, and there were letters back and forth all through August as to my journey homeward. I don't think it suited Papa to travel westwards for me, and as it happened in the end, it was arranged that I would travel as far as Toledo with Uncle and his business associate, Mr. P.B. Weir, because they were going to look at stock for Mr. Weir's store anyway, and I would meet Papa there, who would bring me back on the train. Uncle and P.B. Weir were not taking the train to Toledo, but going by horseback, and this was the cause of some of the letters, as Papa insisted it was too long of a journey for me, but Uncle wrote back to say there wasn't one bother with my riding skills, and I was hardy as they came. He said I could have taken Devil the Stallion if I wanted, but I politely declined. It was decided that I would wear chaps, a cape, and a wide hat so as to blend in on the road. This suited me fine. It was much more comfortable like that on a horse anyway. And besides, as Aunt said, I was still only a young'un, and what did it matter how I dressed? Half September gone, when it came time to part, Auntie had fat tears running down her cheeks, and I had to bite my lip, for it was all quivering, and I had to wipe my own waterworks with the back of my hand. "I'll miss you," she said, and squeezed me tight. I wasn't used to affection like this. I felt all hot in my heart. I couldn't say a thing. No words would come out at all. My two cousins had made me little presents to keep, a sandbag bunny rabbit, which Auntie had crocheted and they had filled, and some painted pebbles, three in number, which they said were like us, 1, 2, 3. I don't suppose my own siblings missed me or so much. I don't suppose my own siblings missed me so much back at home. Josephine had only sent one letter all summer, and that was to tell me she was engaged now to Master Augustus Hartford. She wrote in big, loopy handwriting and sprayed the letter with perfume. It stank. I could just imagine her goofy smile now that she officially had a beau, and I reckon her countenance had improved. I didn't know what to think of Augustus Hartford, because I had only met him once, and he seemed like a dull drip of a fellow, but I supposed there'd be a fuss with the wedding now, and then she'd be gone, and it would only be me and Mary left to fend off stepmother. I had a strange feeling in my stomach as I rode out of Uncle and Auntie's farm, like I was leaving home, even though I'd only lived there some weeks. It was probably the happiest place I'd ever been, the happiest I'd felt in my whole life. We met P.B. on the road, and he had with him a horse packed with goods for the journey. I was surprised to see another man with him on horseback, and when I saw his face under the hat, I realized it was the man I'd crashed into in the shop that day, George. He smiled when he saw me, and I remembered how kind he'd been about the collision I had caused. I felt my cheeks burn red as we approached, for I had not expected to see this man, and all of a sudden I was conscious of myself. Those ruddy damn cheeks. I'd love to know how to stop the fire brigade. P.B. and Uncle rode on up ahead, as they always seemed to have some business to talk about, and George and I trotted along behind. He said at first he'd thought Uncle had brought a boy along, but when I came near, he knew it was me. "Can't hide that smile, ma'am," he said. "Ma'am." Now, I wasn't sure I liked that form of address one bit. George asked me all manner of questions about myself, about what I thought of this and that, and I wasn't quite sure how to take all this interest, for never before had anyone seemed so concerned as to what I thought. After every question, he'd wait till I answered, staring at me intensely as if my answer mattered most in the world. It was most disconcerting. George had come from Sicily, but moved with his parents as a child, and so his accent was not that strong. That explained his bronzed complexion. After some time, we stopped at a river to let the horses drink, and Uncle lit a fire, and we made dark coffee and ate bread and beans. I felt satisfied indeed, with my stomach full and the coffee buzzing round my head like a honeybee. P.B. said the coffee would keep us going another 20 miles, likely, for that's the kind of good stuff it was. P.B. knew all about groceries, for he was one of the top merchants in Chicago. He said George was one of his best salesmen, and I could see by the way he smiled that he liked the compliment. I hadn't thought too much about where we were to spend the night, but Auntie had mentioned that we would find a boarding house along the way. This had caused some chat between her and Uncle, for he said I was at risk in a boarding house, though at risk of what, I don't know. Auntie said anything could happen on the road either, that we could be robbed or attacked. Papa had often talked about the dangers of driving cattle, for rustling was common, and those Indian folks were clever at it. They'd steal horses and food if they got it, so you had to keep your wits about you and keep watch all day and all night. It was best if you could strike first to show your firepower and your mettle. I was a bit afraid of meeting Indians along the way, truth be told, but I kept that to myself, for I didn't want to seem like a chicken. Or worse, a girl. After another few hours in the saddle, when I didn't want to admit it, but found my buttocks and legs were terribly sore, PB put up his hand and brought us all to a halt. He peered off to the side of the trail down a valley where, between black cherry trees, rose the smoke of an encampment. To my horror, I saw they were Indians. I knew by their headgear and horses, which were not rigged up in saddles or bridles like ours, but a mix of skewbald and piebald and all wild-looking. PB looked on, then dismounted his horse and walked slowly to the top of the ridge. He called down to the Indians, and I nearly fainted. What was he doing? Why did he alert them to us? Waiting for the sound of a spear whizzing through the air, like I'd read in the New York ledgers, I watched as PB smiled, then turned back to us and gestured. He wanted us to go and meet the Indians. "Uncle," I said helplessly, my fear betraying me now. "It's all right," said Uncle, and I watched as he too disappeared over the edge after PB. George looked at me and smiled, all calm and warm and reassuring. "PB has a way with the Indians. These are Ojibwe," he said. "Don't you worry." I had to strain all the way back as my horse made its way down the hill, and I could feel the coolness of the air and the shelter of the valley. I felt like I was dropping to my death. There were four Ojibwe at the camp, small in stature, their skin that deep dark color they always wrote about in the magazines, though it wasn't red like it always said. Really, it was brown, almost like George's. They sat around a smoking campfire and were all working on a buffalo robe. One was chopping up roots on a flat stone and throwing them into a boiling pot on the fire. They had all stood up by the time I reached them and got off my horse and stood close to her, for I wanted the shelter of her body and felt vulnerable sitting atop. PB offered them a gift straight away of coffee and biscuits, and they took it readily and placed it with their own belongings. They began to examine his bags as he walked around his horse with them. I realized they were conversing and would probably make a trade. PB smiled and gestured a lot, and he seemed to know some of their language, for they could communicate and seemed to trust him. I stood well back. I did not trust these Indians. How did we know they wouldn't turn and scalp us at any second? That's what Indians did, given half the chance with the white man, or woman. One of the Indians gestured to Uncle and George to sit, and they did, letting their horses go toward the river for a drink. My horse was itching with thirst, but I didn't sit down with the others and instead led her to the water by her bridle. I hoped PB would do his trade, and then we would be on our way, as it was getting near dusk now, and the nearest town still looked to be at least an hour's ride away. We might have to light lamps should darkness come in quickly. But there was no moving on PB. After his trading was done, and I could see that he was a businessman, for he drove a hard bargain with those Indians, taking many more items off them than he seemed to be giving away, PB announced that the men had asked us to make camp with them. I shook my head in horror. No, 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 no. I looked to Uncle, thinking he'd be shaking his head like me, but instead he nodded and looked at me to confirm. "Teddy, tie up your horse over there and give her a good brushing. Then help us with supper." Supper? We were going to eat with the savages? The very savages who were known to attack and scalp our own? I knew going on the road was going to be an adventure, but not this kind, not where we chose to walk into the mouth of danger and dine there. I brushed down my mare and tried to calm my breathing, but I felt as tense as a catapult pulled all the way back. When we had looked after the horses, we got to preparing the food, and warily I did as I was asked by Uncle without looking up to catch those dangerous Indian eyes. Instead, I glanced at their ponies, noting the decorations they had all in their manes and even painted, it seemed, on their rumps. The Indians seemed glad of the company and made conversation with Uncle and George, and then I realized they were talking about me and asking who was my father. Uncle looked around and laughed and said he didn't know the Ojibwe word for niece, so he said that he was my father because it was simply easier. This made PB and George laugh. One of the Indians pointed at George and then to me and gestured with his hand. That's another typo. Together? He was asking if we were together. George laughed out loud and nodded. Not yet, he said. Not wife yet. This made everyone laugh then, except me, and I did not appreciate that they were talking like this about me. No, sir, as if I couldn't hear or wasn't there, and I turned away and thought about burning the fried beans on purpose just to show them. When the food was ready, we ate it out of our tin cans. I was ordered to do the washing up, and I was still hot and bothered over this situation we got ourselves in. George said he'd help me because he could see, I think, that I had gone in on myself, and as we gathered the crockery down to the stream to rinse it all over before washing it in water boiled from the pot, George was kindly and told me he hoped I realized he was only joking earlier. Well, it might have been a joke to him, but I knew those Indians thought that I might be getting on to be his wife, for everyone knew that Indians took their wives young. I stayed quiet, not giving George the satisfaction of going along with their jesting. "Sure didn't mean to insult you, Miss Teddy," he said. "I would hate to think I hurt your feelings or something." I thought on it for a few moments and told him that it was all right, for he was kindly, I knew, and I was feeling all out of sorts there and then. "I don't understand it," I said, as I watched beans fall from the plates and float away on the stream. "All I ever heard about is how dangerous the Indians are, how they attack us and steal from us, and that's why the frontier posts were all set up to protect the white folks." "Well," said George, "some of that's true. There are tribes who attack, but you know, miss, the Indians have got a lot more to be fearful in white folks than the other way around." "They're savages," I said, scraping at some buttery grease with my fingers. "Now, I wouldn't say that," George said, frowning. "I don't think that's a nice word. Would savages sit round the campfire and offer us their food? Would they joke and laugh with us, like you saw?" I shook my head. I didn't know. All I knew was about what I read, what I'd heard from Papa and his road stories, which, truth be told, I sometimes wondered might have been a bit exaggerated. "PB was engaged to a maiden from the Odawa tribe," said George. "His family interfered, and there was a stop put to it. That's why he loves this camping out, being with the Indian people. He feels connected to them, you see. They have a deep connection with the land and wildlife. PB reveres that about them." I looked back to where PB was smoking some sort of elaborate pipe with the Indians now. They were all laughing. It was hard to match up this hard-nosed businessman with these folks in their feathers and moccasins. "His family gave him the money to buy the store when he broke off the engagement." I looked at George. He was letting me in on a secret. I was sure PB and Uncle, for that matter, would not like me to be knowing this personal business of his. So PB had traded an Indian wife for a business life. George helped me carry the dishes back up to camp, and I got to thinking that maybe these folks weren't so bad if PB was so keen on them. When darkness fell, we rolled out our sleeping mats and blankets, and I lay on my back wondering how many snakes were all around us in the nearby undergrowth. I watched as one of the Ojibwe undressed, peeling off his jacket and changing into a softer wrap around type of blanket. I noticed how every muscle stood out on his naked torso, lean and square, like a hard slab of flat, square butter. I couldn't take my eyes off his skin. He caught me looking, and I turned away. Never before had I been exposed to such men. I didn't know what to think or how to feel. I wrapped myself up tight in my blanket, willing sleep to come so that the morning would be here and we would be on our way. PB struck up some sort of chanting with the Indians then, and their voices rang out, soulful, creating vibrations that seemed to hang in the air and chase all the spirits away. Or perhaps they were inviting them in. I didn't know. Before we drifted off to sleep, I heard PB talking with the Ojibwe about a murder that had happened in Arizona, where 23 Indians had been killed by county rangers in the Aquarius Mountains. They killed the men, women, and children. PB said it happened too often. One of the Ojibwe said the white men were shooting buffalo, bang, 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 thousands dropping for no good reason at all. It was a waste. Another said the white men had been chasing the game away. First they came for the beavers. Now the buffalo were next. Soon they would be gone. Already birds and animals abundant had all but disappeared in places, to say nothing of felling trees for lumber. "They want us to be farmers," said one of the men, "but it is not our way of life. They tell us to move to cities, there, jobs, but there are no jobs, always lies," I heard another say. I was almost asleep when I was taken from my slumber by an almighty scream, and we all sat up to find George biting at his hand and plunging it into the embers of the fire. We rushed upon him, and he told us, while he held his hand deep in the embers and ash, that a snake had bitten him on the palm. It had crawled into his boots, and when he lifted them to move them, it had stuck its head out and snapped him quick as a flash. The Ojibwe wanted to know what sort of snake it was, but it was Uncle who said it was most likely a cottonmouth, and that George had done the right thing by biting the poison out and sealing the wound. Still, there was the chance that there was some still in there, and as George didn't seem to be feeling pain from his burn, he was running the risk of losing his whole hand, arm, or worse. George was not to go to sleep, but to walk it off, and we would need to stay up with him to make sure he didn't go into a delirium. Well, I knew there'd be no sleep for me then anyway, for how could I sleep now knowing the worst had happened and that a snake really had come into our camp and done its worst? For the rest of the night, we took it in turns, keeping George awake, and as the hours passed and we listened to the cry of coyotes and owls, the exhaustion overcame me till I begged to be let sleep just for an hour, and I lay down on my mat and passed out, snakes be damned. In the morning, a weary George, now in terrible pain with his burned snake-bite hand, was gray in the face, but alive. I was glad of that, for I liked George. I blamed PB for setting up this damn camp with the Indians. I bet, had we stopped at a boarding house, there wouldn't have been no cottonmouth in our boots. It was a forlorn party who set off the next morning, except for PB, who grinned from ear to ear and said he always felt refreshed with the energy of a sprite after a night spent under the stars. I didn't know what to think. I suppose I had changed my opinion somewhat on the Indians, but definitely not on snakes. Snakes are still the worst thing God ever invented. Why did he have to set them on the same earth as he invented butterflies and blueberries? It's one of life's great mysteries, I suppose.